580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This week, Media Minutes takes a look at five of the most important media stories of 2009.
With President Obama in the White House, 2009 saw a new lineup at the Federal Communications Commission. Julius Genachowski took over as chairman in June, extolling the values of a data-driven FCC. Minion Clyburn and Meredith Atwell Baker also joined as commissioners in the summer. Clyburn, a South Carolina utility regulator, is the daughter of House Majority Whip James Clyburn. Baker was the acting head of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. She's the daughter-in-law of former Secretary of State James Baker. This new commission will be tackling crucial telecommunications issues, including open internet rules, a review of media ownership, and the National Broadband Plan.
The battle over the future of the internet was reignited in 2009, with both Congress and the FCC taking up the issue of net neutrality, the principle that keeps internet service providers from blocking or slowing down websites or lawful applications on the web. In July, Representatives Edward Markey and Anna Eshoo introduced the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2009, a bill that would make net neutrality the law. And in September, FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski introduced a rulemaking at the agency, which received immediate praise from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, several prominent members of Congress, and President Obama. The proposed rules would codify the four open internet principles that now guide the FCC's oversight and enforcement of communications law. The rules would codify new principles that would prohibit internet service providers from discriminating against content or applications and ensure that network management practices are transparent. For more information on net neutrality, visit savetheinternet.com.
Activists waged a war on cable news programs in 2009. Cable networks came under fire for commentary from two anchors, Lou Dobbs of CNN and Glenn Beck of the Fox News Channel. Dobbs drew extensive criticism for his anti-immigrant views and for giving a platform to conspiracy theory claims that President Obama is not a U.S. citizen. This past fall, Presente.org and an alliance of local allies across the country founded Basta Dobbs, a campaign devoted to educating the Latino community about the threat posed by CNN's Lou Dobbs, and another coalition, DropDobbs.com, targeted Dobbs advertisers. Dobbs resigned from his program in November. And ColorOfChange.org organized a massive boycott of advertisers for Fox's Glenn Beck show. After Beck called President Obama a racist and claimed that the president has a, quote, deep-seated hatred of white people, the nonprofit organization began calling on advertisers to stop airing their commercials on Beck's show. Their efforts have paid off. 80 advertisers, including Geico, Procter & Gamble, Applebee's, and General Mills, pulled their ads from the program.
It's been 10 years since Congress restricted low-power FM stations to mostly rural communities, but 2009 looks to be the turning point that could change all that. Just before breaking for the holidays, the House of Representatives passed the Local Community Radio Act. The bill, which would allow nonprofit organizations like colleges and community groups the chance to own and operate their own radio stations, has been introduced in the previous three congressional sessions, but never made it to the House floor. LPFM advocates are now looking towards the Senate in 2010 to pass the bill, which has already moved unanimously out of committee. To learn more about local radio, visit PrometheusRadio.org.
Comcast, the largest cable and residential broadband provider in the country, announced in late November that they are going to purchase a controlling stake in NBC Universal, one of the largest media companies in the world. If approved by federal regulators, this merger would create a media behemoth that reaches hundreds of millions of homes and stretches across content production and distribution, movie and television studios, and broadcast television stations. The merger, which will be the first deal of its scope and size under the Obama administration, is strongly opposed by public interest and consumer groups. Free Press is organizing public opposition to the merger and coordinating an effort to call on Washington to ensure that the deal gets a thorough review by regulators. To find out more, visit freepress.net/Comcast.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, the first program of 2010 on January 3rd here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you after Media Minutes today, not doing the intro before, so we go direct to our guest. As many of you know, one of the constant themes that we touch on here at Media Matters is the state of the economy and the nature of journalism and its coverage and treatment of economic issues. We've been very privileged to have on the program Paul Krugman, Dean Baker, Mark Weisbrot, James Galbraith, any number of leading economists or economic journalists, and today is no exception. Today we have the privilege of being joined by John Cassidy, who writes about economics and financial matters for The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books, and is the author of a brand new book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities, just published, within weeks, if I'm not mistaken. And I've had the privilege of reading it this week, and he's joining us on the phone lines. Mr. Cassidy, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for inviting me on. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, I've been reading your book for the last couple weeks over the Christmas break and enjoying it a great deal. And it's really quite an accomplishment. As you make a reference yourself towards the end, it's really two or three books in one book. And I picked it up expecting to get sort of a detailed journalistic account of the financial crisis and economic crises of the past two or three years from your purview as a journalist covering the economy, only to discover the first two-thirds of it is a tour of economic theory and going back to Adam Smith and weighing in on all sorts of issues that was quite astonishing, frankly.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I thought there'd be, quite a few sort of narrative accounts of the crisis, and there have been some very good ones. And I thought, what was lacking was a sort of overview and try and put it into some sort of historical context, especially in terms of the history of economics. And that's what I tried to do. So it's very gratifying that you and others appear to, appreciate the fact that it's sort of slightly different from some of the other books out there.
Well, it's clear from reading the book. It's clear that you have a gift for taking complex ideas and making them understandable. But even more impressive is that you have really a good training and education in economics. What is your background?
I've been studying economics on and off for 25 years now. I studied it as an undergraduate in Oxford back in the early 80s. Then I did a postgraduate studies. I did a year as a sort of visiting student at Harvard. And I did a master's degree in economics at NYU. That's the sort of extent of my formal qualifications. But I've been reading and thinking about economics as a journalist since I started in journalism in like 1986, so it's 23 years now. So it makes me feel old, but I've been thinking about these issues for a very long time. And one of the things I've been thinking of doing is providing a sort of history of economic thought, because I think a lot of ordinary people, intelligent people, but people who are not versed in economics find it a very forbidding subject. If you pick up an economics textbook, it tends to be written in mathematics. And yet these ideas are thrown around all the time in policy and in the media, and I think they're not very well understood. So, as I say, I've been thinking of writing a sort of populist history of economics or book about economics for a long time. And then the financial crisis happened, and it seemed to me that a lot of the sort of ultimate causes of it were wrapped up in economic theory and misapplication of various economic ideas. So I ended up, as you say, sort of writing two books at the same time, one a history of economics and one a sort of analysis of the financial crisis and where it came from.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understood your book, Mr. Cassidy, you wrote about how the rise of what you call utopian economics to ascension to being accepted by policymakers and pundits and politicians and academics in the past generation or two was a significant factor in leading to the tremendous errors that led to the economic crisis.
Right.
And if I read your book correctly, you're basically walking us through the rise of utopian economics and it's the severe problems with it and why we should junk it.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, the book is divided into thirds. The first third of the book is an account of what I call utopian economics, which is this basic idea which does go back to Adam Smith, that free markets left to their own devices, relying on self-interest and competition, will generate a good outcome for society as a whole. Adam Smith referred to that as the invisible hand theory, the invisible hand of the market coordinating everybody's activities in a way that works out for everybody. So I think that that idea works in some parts of the economy quite well, works in things like food production and entertainment, pretty much sort of straightforward common consumer goods. The market does usually generate what people want in roughly the amounts they want. But that doesn't really apply to other parts of the economy, such as especially the financial markets, when you need to take a slight more complicated approach to economics. And that's what I try and do in the second part of the book, where I talk about what I call reality-based economics, which is economics which takes account of some of the problems you can run into in the economy, like speculative bubbles and monopoly power and pollution, things like that. And then the final third of the book, having developed these economic theories and tried to show where they come from and talk about the thinkers who are associated with them, I then try and apply some of these ideas to the subprime mortgage collapse and the subsequent global recession, trying to point out how ultimately this was an example of a big market failure. There's a lot of debate about that. Some people blame the government. But I think ultimately it was an example of markets sort of running out of control because they weren't adequately supervised, and it was ultimately a market failure. So that's what I'm trying to... the message I'm trying to get across in the book is not that free markets never work, but that they don't always work. It seems to me that following... basically from the sort of early 1980s onwards, when we had the sort of Thatcher revolution in the UK and the Reagan revolution in the US, this idea that markets always work to the benefits of everybody came to be taken very seriously for some good reasons. I mean, we had the collapse of communism, we had a failure of sort of Keynesianism, the more old-fashioned economics, with the rise of inflation and the industrial relations problems, especially in Europe. And then the rise of China and India, who adopted more free market policies. Free markets do produce a lot of wealth, but they also bring problems with them, especially in terms of, as I say, in things like financial markets and pollution and inequality and other areas. And those sort of shortcomings at the market, it seemed to me, just got sort of forgotten for 10 or 20 years. And my book is a sort of an attempt to redress that balance.
I think... John Cassidy, I was in my crib in the 1950s in Cleveland, Ohio. My father was leaning over and lecturing me on the brilliance of the free market, some of my first memories. And I think for many Americans, that's the upbringing we've had in this country. And many of my students now, I know, know the lines almost by heart. Every American politician knows the genius of the free market and how it can do no wrong, right, left to its own devices. And I think you point out in the book that in the field of economics, historically, a number of brilliant economists have developed the model and have actually demonstrated that under certain conditions I must quickly add that don't hold, but under certain conditions, a free market system does indeed produce the optimum allocation of resources and generation of human happiness. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair summary. I mean, that one of the reasons for why free market economics is so seductive and so attractive to economists is that it does have this logical internal consistency. And as you say, you can actually mathematically prove that under certain conditions, the free market does produce an efficient outcome. Now, what does efficiency mean? It means it produces an outcome in which you can't make any one person any better off without making some other person less well off. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean much, because if you have some very rich people, take some money from the very rich and give them to the very poor, that's a violation of sort of efficiency in that way. But it does mean that the market sort of exploits some of the potential gains from trade available, and does, as I say, in certain circumstances, produce what is an ideal outcome, and that can be proved mathematically. The problem, that which is what happened, as I try to explain, in the first half of the 20th century, and the sort of the key paper was actually written in 1953 by an American, Kenneth Arrow, who is still alive and is associated with Stanford, and Gerard de Brieux, a French mathematician economist who died a few years ago. So in terms of inside professional economics, that strain of thinking has been extremely important. I think it's neglected in the public discussions. Most people, most journalists certainly aren't aware of that whole tradition.
You know,
even
it was
though
striking
it's quite dense, I did try and provide a version of how that sort of thought came about and the people associated with it. As I say, the problem with it is it's an ideal system. The people who came up with these theories, like Ken Arrow, never suggested that it applies to reality. In fact, they thought of it in terms of showing how stringent the requirements are for this system to work.
If I can interrupt you for 1 second, Mr. Cassidy, as I read your account of Kenneth Arrow, his argument, if I read it properly, was that actually the market system is actually so malleable that a society could institute all sorts of progressive governmental reforms and the market system would adapt to them.
No, that's true. I mean, you can take Ken Arrow's work either way. There is this sort of two theories. First theory is that the economy, the free market economy, produces an efficient outcome. That seems to say, well, that's great for free markets. That's called the first fundamental theorem of welfare economics. But there's also a second fundamental theorem of welfare economics, which Kenneth Arrow also came up with. And what that says is that there's a whole range of outcomes you can choose in the market. Some may be fair, some may be unfair. And if you decide to choose one of the fairer ones, the way you would get that fair one is by assessing some lump sum taxes and giving them from the relatively wealthy to the relatively poor. The free market, as you say, is so malleable and the price system is such a wondrous thing that it can actually produce a set of prices which will support that ideal outcome. So it's not even just that the free market is a great thing. It's a great thing which can be manipulated by the government to produce a sort of ideal outcome, which some economists refer to as a sort of bliss point. That was all proven mathematically. As I say, the problem with it is that the conditions you need for these theorems to hold just don't hold in reality. You need a complete set of markets for all sorts of futures markets. You need to be able to order ice cream to be bought in 2 or 3 years. You need to be able to insure yourselves against all sorts of hazards. There needs to be perfect information so that you don't have situation where people are buying stocks and securities which they don't know much about. There can't be any sort of herd behavior or bubble type behavior. There can't be any monopoly, so you can't have companies like Google or Microsoft which have monopoly power. All these things violate the free market theories. Now, economists have known that for many years, but for some reason it sort of hasn't made it into the public domain very much. And certainly in Washington and in London, the policy debate gets cast in terms of these sort of free market ideals, which don't really have that much to do with reality.
Our guest today in Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is John Cassidy, author of the new book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. John Cassidy writes for The New Yorker and the New York Review of Books on Economic Matters. He had an earlier book, .com, which came out almost a decade ago, and I used that, Mr. Cassidy, in my undergraduate course with great success when it came out.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, this book is sort of a sequel to .com because the subject matter is another speculative bubble, you know, this time in housing and in credit. But this .com was largely a narrative of what had happened. This book does provide something of a narrative, but it's a much broader book.
I would have to add, I think this book is much deeper and richer in terms of what it brings to the understanding of the current moment.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much. Yeah, well, as I say, I mean, I've already written one narrative account of a bubble. I didn't really fancy doing another one. And I had all these things I'd been thinking about for many years, so it was a good opportunity to try and trot them out there.
You know, in the book, you do a long discussion of sort of the problems with utopian-based economics and how it got us into the problems and what you call reality-based economists. And you use the field of economics basically to critique this free market utopia and the
right.
Hard research in the field. And you've already listed some of the core problems, the assumptions that don't hold. But these have real-world effects, though, when the policies don't take into consideration the problems you've been talking about.
A good example of that, I mean, we've been speaking a lot about financial markets, but one of the other big issues obviously around at the moment is global warming, climate change, whatever you want to call it. Now, most people tend to think of global warming as a sort of technological problem or a geographical problem, but actually it can also be thought of as an economic problem because the real source of the problem is that the market are not really working properly. What do I mean by that? If you think of where the big sources of carbon emissions are, power stations, SUV owners, etc. They don't. The market doesn't really force them to take account of their actions. What do I mean by that? I mean, the prices a power station pays for, say, oil or some other fossil fuel doesn't include the cost of cleaning up the mess that it makes in terms of both in terms of just straightforward pollution, but also in this case in terms of its long-term impact on the climate. Markets, the big argument for markets working is that they balance benefits and costs. The private cost of something is matched, the price adjusts so the private cost of an item is equal to the private benefit, and that's what leads to an efficient outcome. The problem is that's true in a lot of places in terms of private benefits and private costs, but it doesn't account for social costs. And the social costs in this case can be astronomical because all the individual power stations and SUV users around the world, you know, if it's true that global warming is happening, and I'm taking that as an assumption, I'm not getting into the debate about global warming, I'm just assuming it's happening, then, you know, we can have catastrophic impact of private rationality and competition. That is what economists refer to as an externality. It produces an external effect which the market doesn't account for. Now, that idea is not a new idea at all. As I point out in the book, it goes back to the beginning of the 20th century to an English economist called Arthur Cecil Pigou, funny name, but at the time he was very famous, was actually more famous than Maynard Keynes, who was at Cambridge University at the same time as him. And Pigou spelled out this difference between social cost and private costs and how markets couldn't take account of it. And his argument was that you needed the government to take account of it by imposing taxes on damaging activities. Now, 100 years later, we're finally getting around to that idea in global warming, the idea for a carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system, which is basically a disguised tax. The idea is basically to try and bring the social costs in line with the market price by forcing people to pay taxes for emitting carbon. So it's funny how, you know, how long these ideas take to come to fruition, but they're certainly not new, a lot of them. And as you say, what I'm trying to do in this book, it's a critique of sort of free market economics from within the economics profession, because I think so many people think that free market economics is the sort of orthodoxy. That has become true to a large extent in the last 20 or 30 years, but there's a whole history of economics before that, and even up to the present day, of economists questioning this basic free market model and providing a whole litany of ways in which it can fail to reflect reality.
Our guest, John Cassidy, author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. He's joining us today live on Media Matters. We'll be talking about the financial crisis and the politics that are going on in Washington and globally today to address the economic crisis in the second half of the program, which he covers in his book and in his writings. Our phone number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to join us with a question or comment, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now to a patient caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with John Cassidy.
Hi. Productive and happy new year, I guess I'll say. I'm struck by the fact that this, as you point out, this stuff isn't new, and the idea of externalities has always been a part of economics. And when the externality is threatening the global climate system, obviously it has to be weighed in, and nothing is being done really to do that. But since you do start with this broad stroke, I wanted to mention that it's curious that the political analyst and linguist Noam Chomsky, in an address he gave called Free Market Fantasies, which you can get quite easily, has these quotes from our invisible hand fellow show that he was already concerned about what he called the power of combines, which was basically corporate power in our day. And so that also is not new under the sun. And I just wanted to ask you to comment on that. I'm more skeptical of the market, even at the level of food production. And we don't really have a free market in food production. We have subsidies for corn and that are not good for anywhere else in the world, and we take them away with our IMF policies, et cetera. But they're good for us. So I don't think there's anything such. And I think Michael Albert, who you've had on, this whole idea of a participatory economics, which is even more possible because of the information technology that we actually have now. Someone has, I guess, is the way I put it. Well, that's inchoate and not really a question, but I guess I'll ask you for some response on that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And John Cassidy, before you answer, I think if I can summarize, there are two parts there. The first part is the caller's reference to Adam Smith and how, in fact, he was not necessarily the sort of gung-ho Milton Friedman utopian free market fanatic that his name is invoked to justify often. And maybe you could comment on that. And some of the other economists like Arrow, right, and who are held up in that light at times as justifying and defending and advocating that position. And the second point was simply, I think, a broader concern a lot of people are having today when they look at arguments you're making about market failure, that when you get down to the markets that actually do work like they're supposed to in the Milton Friedman's textbook, they're few and far between. Maybe we need to stay, instead of looking at them as the rule, they should be seen as the exception and then really rethink the whole process.
I'll take that as its own turn. I mean, Adam Smith is a fascinating character. I was one of the people who, before I wrote this book, thought that he basically was just, you know, a sort of free market guy. But I went back and actually read The Wealth of Nations, which very few people do because it's a very long book and it's written in 18th century English, so it's tough to get through. But it's actually fascinating if you go through it because, as the caller inferred, even though Smith had this basic idea about the invisible hand and the sort of great productive powers of the free markets, he was also very skeptical of actual businesses and has a famous quote which says, you know, that whenever two businessmen gather together, they're usually trying to conspire against the public. So he was all in favor of trying to break up monopolies and things like that. The other thing, I knew that, but what I didn't know was that Smith was also very skeptical of banks and the banking system. He has a section which I point to in my book where he refers to a local bank in the town in Scotland where he lived, which had lent far too much money to local businesses which didn't really have proper business opportunities. The businesses then failed to repay the loans, and the bank went bankrupt and plunged the entire local economy into a recession. And Smith said, you know, this is an example of how free markets can malfunction, and he actually called for strict banking regulation and said banks should be controlled strictly. He said he realized that this was a violation of his sort of laissez-faire policies he'd called for elsewhere in the economy, but he said the consequences of bank failure were just so high that it was justified in this case. Now, if you spin forward a couple of hundred years and think about what's happened in the last couple of years, we basically had that sort of banking crisis on a large scale. Banks lent money to people, to too many people and businesses that they shouldn't have done. They then got into trouble and they plunged the entire economy into a recession. That's a form of externality, actually, which we didn't realize existed in the financial system. When banks fail, they can bring down the entire economy. If your corner store fails, it's bad news for you, but doesn't have much impact on people who don't live nearby. But the banking system, when it gets into trouble, can, as I say, have devastating effects on the entire economy. So that's Adam Smith, and as I say, I think it'll certainly have been listened to Alan Greenspan and various others over the past 10, 15 years talking about Adam Smith at length. I don't think they ever referred to Adam Smith calling for stricter banking regulation.
You know, if I can interject, one of the things you did in your book, John Cassidy, that I found very illuminating was you drew out and developed the point that finance has traditionally played a very small role in economic theory, and the sort of willy-nilly adaptation of the utopian free market model to finance is a very recent development and completely out of the character of the work until quite recently.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the fascinating things about the history of economics, really. If you go back even sort of to mid-20th century, most economics didn't really take much account of the financial markets. There was this idea that the sort of most important thing in the economy was technology and the labor force and capital investment, and that the monetary system was just somehow sat on top of all this and was what some economists referred to as a veil.
A dependent variable. It
didn't actually affect the inner functionings of the economy that much. It just affected actual sort of nominal variables like prices. That idea, I think, you know, has now gone by the by, and we realize that finance can have a big impact on the economy. But to get to the other part of your question, you're right. What happened in the latter part of the 20th century, largely as a result of theories that came out of the University of Chicago, the so-called efficient markets hypothesis and the rational expectations hypothesis. These theories basically applied the invisible hand theories of self-regulated markets to the financial system. And they said that not only do free markets do a good job in consumer goods and entertainment or something like that, and I can get back to the caller's question of whether they actually do that, but not only do they do well in those areas, but they also do well by themselves in financial systems, so we should just leave Wall Street to regulate itself. That was a very radical, you know, development of free market doctrine, and it became very influential in the 80s and 90s, culminating in, you know, the great deregulatory reforms of 1999, when Glass-Steagall, the 1930s-era regulation, was abolished. So I try and trace the development of those two theories, the efficient markets hypothesis and the rational expectations hypothesis, which may not be very well known to the public, although they've had quite a bit of publicity in the last few years. But inside the economics profession, they've had an astonishing amount of influence over the last 25 years.
You know, I do want to go to the current situation, but I do want to touch on one other economist who looms very large in your book and very large in contemporary discussions, who's John Maynard Keynes, who you've mentioned already. And Keynes, as you develop at some length, also had extraordinarily keen sensitivity to the importance of the financial sector, unlike many economists since then.
Yeah, I mean, Keynes, the difference between Keynes and a lot of modern economists, I think, is that even though he was a brilliant academic, he also spent most of his life he was a very keen investor. He was an advisor to the British Treasury. He served on lots of commissions to do with the financial markets, and he was a director of an insurance company. There's nothing like actual practical awareness to overcome sort of theoretical preconceptions. So Keynes was always very skeptical of this idea that free financial markets worked efficiently. And he actually developed an alternative theory of investing called the beauty contest theory of investing, which is the idea back in the 1930s, there used to be, it was a very sexist era, they used to have beauty contests in British newspapers. They'd have maybe 10, 12 pictures of pretty girls, and you had to pick who was the prettiest. Now, if you think about how you would play that game, if you were a free market economist, you would think, well, who is the actual prettiest, and base your sort of investment or your bet on fundamentals. But if you're a Keynesian, what Keynes said you should do is actually, you're not really interested in who the prettiest is, but in who the average opinion thinks is the prettiest. So you have to start thinking about what other people think. And that's actually a very important point to take in mind when you think about how financial markets work. According to free market theory, everybody in the financial markets is desperately trying to find out what's the real value of these stocks and these bonds. How much money are they going to generate in the future? What are the economic fundamentals? According to Keynes, the rational way to play financial markets is actually not to bother about all that stuff, but to actually try and mimic what everybody else is doing. Because if everybody's buying, chances are stocks will go up. You can get in, maybe get out before the pack. So his idea was that you can have rational herd behavior. That idea was then sort of forgotten for quite a long time and was actually picked up again in the 1990s by a group of economists who were then at Harvard, who did produce some papers which questioned the efficient markets hypothesis. Ironically, one of the authors of one of those papers was Larry Summers, the soon-to-be Treasury Secretary, who then, when he became a senior official, actually seemed to sort of renege on his own theories and took the view that financial markets could be left to their own devices. So it's sort of disconnect between his theory and his practical views, I think.
There's such a wealth of material in the book leading us up to the present day on Keynes in particular, but really covering a number of prominent historians or economists. But I do think we should get on to the current events, which take last third of the book. And again, for those just tuning in, our guest is John Cassady, author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. This book has just been published. I mean, you have references in the book as late as June of 2009. Just quite an accomplishment for your publisher.
Thanks. Yeah, we finished it sort of in July, August, and it just came out. It came out last month, so it's reasonably up to date.
More than reasonably. Those who'd like to call in with a question for John Cassady, the number again 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Now, I don't want to dwell too much on the details of the great speculative bubble of the last 5 or 10 years, because we've had discussed that on the show before, and there are other places
sure.
for it. But I do think you should maybe just, if you could touch on a few of the most salient points you think that people should know to understand the situation we're in today, what would they be?
Well, I mean, the various theories of what happened. There's, I think the man on the street thinks in terms of sort of greed and criminality, and sort of Madoffism writ large, that was large, you know, this was just all a matter of greed. In the economics world, there are a couple of theories. One is that this was all a case of sort of mass irrationality and crowd behavior, that everybody got way too overconfident, and they sort of forgot that markets can go down as well as they can go up. My theory is that I think there was some criminality and there was some overconfidence, but actually the problems were deeper than that, and they relate to how the incentives that the market provided to people. What do I mean by that? Again, going back to the sort of free market theory, the idea is that the prices which reign in the market give people the right incentives. Prices are too high, people step in and they sell. If prices are too low, people step in and they buy. That's how prices of stocks and bonds or houses or whatever reflect economic fundamentals. But actually what happens once you get a speculative bubble going is that instead of doing that, everybody involved has an incentive to try and ride the bubble. And that's what I try and explain in the book, how what I refer to as rational irrationality. What do I mean by that? I mean, it was privately rational for the investment bankers and the house owners and even the regulators to sort of let the bubble keep running, even though it added up to collective irrationality. If you think of the subprime mortgage industry, it was basically a chain, starting off with the people who were buying the houses or taking out the subprime mortgages. You know, it was a very good deal for them. They could get 95-100% mortgages on properties that they otherwise couldn't have afforded, and as long as the housing market kept going up, they had a good chance of making a lot of money. If the housing market turned down, they would lose their deposit, but in a lot of cases their deposit was very small anyway. So it was it was a sort of rational thing to do, to try and play the market, the housing market, as a speculative game. And that's what we found in places like Florida and Arizona. You know, up to 40-50% of the house price of the home purchases at the top of the market were speculators who were basically buying them to flip. Doesn't mean there weren't, you know, a lot of honest people who tried to get involved, but and just buy a nicer house. But there was also a lot of speculation. Then you look at the Wall Street banks who were enabling this behavior by buying up the subprime mortgages and pooling them into subprime mortgage bonds, which they then sold on. It was also perfectly rational from their point of view to do this, because they, you know, there were plenty of willing investors. These mortgage bonds yielded a bit more than treasury bonds, and banks and hedge funds and mutual funds all around the world were desperate for higher yields, so they were willing to buy these securities. In terms of the mortgage lenders who were lending out all this money, they also were acting perfectly rationally, because they knew that once they'd issued these mortgages, they could then sell them on to the mortgage, you know, to Wall Street. They didn't have to keep them on their books. So if the loans went sour, it wasn't the mortgage lender that suffered the loss. It was whoever bought the mortgage bonds. So all the way along the chain, people were acting in what I think was privately rational behavior, even up to the credit rating agencies, which were giving all these things AAA securities because they were being paid by the issuers. And even the regulators and the Federal Reserve Board, because when the economy is growing rapidly, and you know, people seem to be getting wealthy, it's very, very hard politically to turn around and say we're going to burst this speculative bubble. That's what we've found in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
So, as I say, my basic argument is that markets, rather than providing people with the right incentives in a speculative era, they provide people with exactly the wrong incentives. And it's a, you know, you get an enormous market failure.
And you know, in the book, you allude to, actually discuss at some length, Hyman Mitsky, the Keynesian economist who's returned to sort of favor, come into favor with his analysis of the role speculation plays and speculation crises play.
Right. Mitsky is a fascinating guy as well, because like Keynes, he also had a lot of personal experience in the banking industry. For 20 or 30, he was a professor at the University of Washington in St. Louis for a lot of years. And he was also a director at the Mark Twain Bank there in St. Louis. And his personal exposure to the banking system gave him a much clearer idea of how banks operate than most academic economists have, or most purely academic economists have. He saw that once a lending boom gets going, it's very hard for individual banks to not participate, because they see all their rivals lending more money and making more money, and their stock prices going up, etc. So it's very difficult for an individual bank to sit out the boom. So what you get is a progressive deterioration in lending standards. The way banks make money is by lending to people. But the only way you can lend to more and more people is by lending to people who, you know, have very poor credit records eventually. So Minsky, back in the 80s and 70s and 80s, actually, came up with this theory called the financial instability hypothesis, which basically said that in any period of economic stability, such as the one we had from the 80s and in the 80s and 90s, the seeds of future destruction are already growing, because banks are starting to lend to people who don't deserve the money, and you're getting a deterioration in credit quality, and eventually you're going to get a full-scale lending boom, which is going to eventually produce a bust. So Minsky, during his life, he died about 10 years ago, was largely unknown. But it turns out that I think, you know, you can make the argument that of all the economists in the last 20 or 30 years of the 20th century, his writings were among the most prescient.
When you discuss Minsky, you also, you know, let me go off topic for a second. The Onion last year, when the housing market yeah. collapsed, had a headline, which I think by your laugh, you might remember it. Nation awaits new bubble to pop up the economy.
I mean, they actually hit on a very important point there. I mean, if you think about the U.S. economy for the last, let's take it back to the 80s, for example, we've really had three enormous bubbles. There was a great lending bubble in the 1980s, which culminated in the SNL crisis. It wasn't as national as the one 20 years later, but it was a big housing and lending bubble across much of the South. Then in the 90s, we had 10 years of relative prosperity, but which culminated in the stock market bubble and the great dot-com boom and bust. And then the Fed slashed interest rates again in 2003-2004, and we had the great housing bubble, which was the biggest bubble of all. So what this suggests is that, bubbles are not some sort of exception to the rule in the modern economy. They actually might be the rule.
Well, that in the Minsky discussion you had, you referred to Monthly Review and Paul Sweezy and their argument, which comes out of a strong Keynesian and Marxian sort of merger, that the normal state of modern capitalism, in the United States at least, is one of stagnation and slow growth, and it requires increasingly, because the real economy can't generate investment, the growth of this financial sector to keep the economy cooking with all the problems that entails.
No, I mean, it's a fascinating line of reasoning. I mean, it actually goes back to, as you say, you can draw it all the way back to Marx, although it's a bit of a stretch. But you can certainly draw it back to Keynes, who back in the late 30s and early 40s, he thought that the big problem once the war ended would be economic stagnation, and lots of American Keynesians did too. They thought, as you say, that the natural sort of state for a mature capitalist economy is stagnation. Now, that sort of view, because we had the great boom of 1945 to 73, which people refer to as the golden years, and then we had another quite a long boom from like 86 or 87 to 2007, the opposite view started to take hold, that actually the sort of Chicago idea that the natural state of a mature capitalist economy is full employment and rapid growth and, prosperity. But underpinning all that, as I said, were these speculative bubbles, which and this massive growth of the financial system and massive growth of credit. So it's going to be fascinating, actually, in the next decade or two, when it seems to me it's unlikely we're going to have the massive growth of credit that we had in the last 20 or 30 years, to see if the U.S. economy and the rest of the global economy can stand on its own two feet without this underpinning from an enormous credit boom. It's going to be actually a sort of interesting test of the two rival views of how capitalism works.
Well, let's go back to our phone lines now. Our guest again, John Cassidy, author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities, just published. Let's go now to line one, Champaign. You're on the air with John Cassidy.
Yes, good afternoon. Fascinating program. I'm not at all a scholar, so I can't speak in terms of what different economists have said over the years, but it has always seemed to me that there's no such thing as an unregulated market, that every market has to be regulated. Even in the simplest markets, there has to be some kind of guard against fraud and outright crime. Things all the way from something as simple as the butcher putting his thumb on the scale to the milk factory adding melamine to the milk. There has to be, those things have to be ruled out, or you can't have a well-functioning market. And that these bubbles that have been you've been talking about are not, in my mind, actual failures of the market mechanism, but they are failures of regulation. Sales and I can't think of the way. The savings and loan problem back in the 1980s. The Reagan administration deregulated the interest rate, but they didn't deregulate the FDIC coverage of the depositors' deposits, and that made it rational for everybody in the game to do the wrong thing. And it seems to me that the problem there is not anything in free markets. The problem is that the rules were set up wrong, and that a similar analysis applies to each of the subsequent bubbles. So that to frame the argument, to frame the argument in terms of regulated versus unregulated is to look at the thing entirely the wrong way. That every market has to be regulated, and the question is it going to be regulated intelligently or not?
Well, thank you very much, caller. John Cassidy?
I think there's a fair... I agree with that up to a point. I mean, the Milton Friedman idea that most markets can be completely unregulated because if one supplier doesn't supply what you want, you'll go to another one, doesn't work. We've had the Food and Drug Administration for decades now, and you know it performs a necessary task. As Adam Smith said, if you leave it all to just individual businessmen, there's so many information problems in the economy and other problems that the markets probably won't work. So we need sort of rudimentary regulation in all markets to just enforce honesty. I mean, that's largely what the caller was referring to in that case, I think. That the larger question about whether this was a failure of government regulation or a failure of the market, I think clearly there were big failures of regulation here. Larry Summers and other people would now, I'm sure if you could get him on the show, would now admit that financial deregulation was pushed too far in various ways in the 1990s and early zeros. Now, is that a failure of government or is it a failure of the market? Well, the government's failure was sort of unleashing the market, right? So it seems to me that it's a bit of a sort of twisted logic to blame the government for this. I'm not saying that's what the caller did. He was making a perhaps more subtle point. But on the right especially now, the sort of fallback position is, okay, we had this enormous economic collapse and this enormous failure on Wall Street, but actually it wasn't the free market that was at fault, it was the government at fault. And I think, yes, the government did play a role in setting up the sort of preconditions and providing some perverse incentives, but the government's failure was largely letting the market out of the box. So I don't see that ultimately is a government failure, unless you say that the government failure was just to allow the market to function as markets will function if you just leave them to their own devices.
We have a caller who's been waiting patiently on a cell phone in Indiana. Let's hope we can still reach that caller. Let's now go to line four. You're on the air with John Cassidy.
Hello, I have a three-part question. First off, I'd like to ask Mr. Cassidy if he believes we really have a free market in credit and finance based on the fact that we have a central bank in total control of the money supply and major interest rates. Second, does he believe that speculative bubbles emerge naturally just out of thin air, out of the market process, or do they have anything to do with central bank policy? And third, is he at all familiar with the concept of free banking, the idea being, and according to Adam Smith, competition being the great regulator of the market, and we really don't have free competition because we have regulation. We don't have free entry in banking. And maybe the idea of free banking being a path towards greater financial stability. And I'd be interested to hear his answers. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. John Cassidy?
Again, I think this is another sort of fallback theory, fallback argument from the right. I don't want to put words into the caller's mouth, but Of course, we don't have a free market in finance, and there's been a central bank since 1913 in the U.S., but we did have a free market in finance in the 19th century, and a lot of banking competition as well. If the free market idea and free banking ideas work, then the economy and the financial system should have been more stable before the advent of the Federal Reserve Board and of modern regulations. In fact, there were far more speculative bubbles and busts in the 19th century than there were in the 20th century. The problem with regulation with the Fed was that after doing a pretty good job from the 1930s to the 1970s, they then went away from the sort of traditional view of what the Fed was supposed to be doing in terms of avoiding speculative bubbles and regulating the financial system. And they adopted these efficient market theories and deregulation, not just the Fed, but obviously Congress as well. And so it seems to me to argue that, you know, what we need is a return to total free banking is to misinterpret, you know, what's happened. Surely what we need is a return to more sensible regulation and the ideas which seem to work pretty well from the 1930s to the 1980s.
The whole battle over re-regulating or increasing the regulation or regulatory reform might be the best term in Washington today towards the financial sector has sort of drifted to the back of the news except in the business pages with healthcare and various wars getting the front seat in the car. Where does it stand now? And does my casual observation that the Obama administration does not seem especially aggressive and towards reform accurate, or is that just because I'm not getting enough news?
Well, I think they want to. They do want to introduce some reforms. Good question about whether they go far enough. But I don't think they've totally given up. But I think your general skepticism is justified. It seems to me the Obama administration made a political error here. Now, this is a controversial argument. Other people would disagree. But I think they would have been better served to put financial regulation on the front burner this year before they did healthcare, for two reasons. Number one, the banking sector 12 months ago, even 9 months ago, was basically on its back, which meant that its lobbying it was totally dependent on handouts from Washington to survive. That meant that its lobbying power and its bargaining leverage were massively reduced. I think at that stage, if the administration had come forward with a series of meaningful reforms, the banks would have had to buckle under and accept them, and they wouldn't have the power on Capitol Hill to fight against them. Instead, the administration put healthcare first and went ahead with all the bailouts and the support from the Federal Reserve for the banking system. That's done a very good job of preventing a financial collapse and an even better job of restoring bank profitability. So banks are no longer cowed, and they are, you know, again fighting against even relatively modest reforms like the idea of regulating mortgages and credit cards, etc. So as I say, I think the administration made a political error, but that may be because, you know, I write about finance. They clearly took the political decision that they'd campaigned on healthcare, and that was their first priority. And, you know, it looks like they are going to get something on that. But certainly financial reform has been a casualty.
You know, John Cassidy, I had Kevin Phillips on my program a while ago, and he's written quite a bit about financialization, as I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah.
And one of his arguments is that as financialization has increased in the U.S. economy and become a much larger factor, that the Democratic Party has increasingly become the party of finance capital. And so expecting reform from the Democratic Party is really not doesn't make a lot of, like expecting labor unions from the Republican Party in 1920s.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, as a matter of fact, that clearly is true if you just look at who the biggest campaign contributors were to the DNC and even to Obama in the last campaign cycle. You know, there's hedge funds and Wall Street interests are high up there. Now, the counter argument to that would be, which I would make, is that even some people on Wall Street are now accept the idea that we need more financial regulation. They realize that left to their own devices, they, because of the problem of irrationality and misplaced incentives, they may well end up blowing up the system once again. So if you listen to the speeches of people like Lloyd Blankfein, the chairman of Goldman Sachs, or Jamie Dimon, chairman of JP Morgan Chase, hardly two radicals, even they have been calling for some some big financial reforms in terms of changing capital requirements and making firms keep some skin in the game, as the phrase goes. Now, these are not revolutionary reforms, and I don't think they go far enough. I'd be in favor of Paul Volcker's idea of actually splitting up the banking system into an unregulated sector and a more, much more closely regulated sector. And but the Obama administration has not gone for that. But I think, as I say, given that even the sort of smart people on Wall Street realized that things had gone wrong and that we need an outside agency to sort of come in and restore a more stable system, and only the government can do that, I think there would have been a way to put together a political coalition to get through some sensible reforms. However, now, as I say, 12 months later, I'm much less confident of that.
Are there politicians or regulators in Washington, specifically in on Capitol Hill, John Cassidy, you think are really, you know, understand the issues and are really doing their best to enact the sort of reform that would be effective?
Well, that's a good question. And now I finished my book, it's about time I went down there and started interviewing some of them to be able to answer the question more effectively. I've been a bit out of the sort of reporting game for the last 12 months. I mean, certainly people like Elizabeth Baird and even Tim Geithner himself knows a lot about the financial system. And some of Geithner's early speeches, which he made back in March and April, where he said the financial system is broken and it needs fixing. This can't just be a sort of Band-Aid. You know, we need wholesale reform. I think that spoke to the fact that he actually realizes what the problem is. The problem is, you know, politically, it's just very hard to get things through. And as you say, at the same time, there is this fundamental question about how far the Obama administration is willing to take on its big Wall Street backers. Having not reporting on that firsthand for last year or so, I'd be sort of reluctant to, you know, put words into these people's mouths. But I certainly haven't been encouraged by what's happened in the last few months.
John Cassidy, we would be remiss to do a program on your book and on the subject of how markets fail were we not to discuss Alan Greenspan, whose name I don't think has come up yet in the last hour, but he plays a significant role in your book. It's, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, he was regarded as almost a deity in American popular culture. And today, he is less than a deity. Is history being fair or unfair to Alan Greenspan?
Well, you know, I think Greenspan sort of rode the roller coaster up, and now he's riding it down, so he can't really complain about his treatment. I mean, I've obviously been skeptical of Greenspan for more than a decade, and my first book was very critical of him, too. I think he will be looked back on as sort of the apotheosis of this idea of utopian economics. His idea, he was, after all, the man above all others, who made the argument that banks won't get the rest of the economy into trouble, that we can rely on their self-interest to protect the rest of us, which is a direct, you know, version, a sort of 20th century version of the invisible hand. Now, he himself appeared on Capitol Hill. I start the book with a scene of him appearing on Capitol Hill at the end of 2008 and admitted that his free market ideology had got him into trouble on this occasion. I actually give Greenspan credit for being intellectually honest. He didn't pretend to not have an ideology. He said, we all have ideologies. You need an ideology to understand the world. And mine had worked for 30 or 40 years, but it didn't work on this occasion. So I feel a bit sorry for Greenspan in the sense that, you know, there is a herd mentality in the media and now everybody's piling in on him, including lots of people who wrote very flattering things about him for many years. But ultimately, I think historians will judge him rather harshly.
Well, John Cassidy, I see our time is drawing to a close. I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule or your weekend to join us here at Media Matters.
Thanks very much for inviting me on. It was fun.
It was fun. And good luck with your, again, very important and readable presentation of economics. My name's Bob McChesney. I want to thank all of you for listening. And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Krohoff for working the board. We'll be back in 1 week with Tom Engelhart joining us. And we'll be talking about politics and foreign policy. So see you in 1 week, everyone. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Although we're expecting to see some sunshine today, a chilly day is in the forecast with a high near 12 and a wind chill between 5 and 15 below throughout the day. Tonight, partly cloudy, overnight low around 0. The wind chill between 4 and 13 below. And then tomorrow should be mostly sunny, a high near 14, the wind chill 3 to 13 below. This is Illinois Public Media.